in the trees, a potential snare. Close my eyes and block my ears. Cut the cord and leave me here.
Welcome back to Phantom Island, presented by Homefield. Today, we have a very special edition of, let's call it Numbers and Numbers and Words, because we've got double the numbers, and I don't even know if I'm supposed to be words with Godfrey not here today, but I'll try to fill the spot for him. I have Bill Connolly, ESPN writer, author of Forward Progress, the definitive guide to the future of college football, and I might add, pretty nice little holiday gift if you're trying to figure out what to get family members and friends. And don't have any ideas, just go ahead and why not give them the future of college football that they can hold in their hands?
Even if it doesn't really reveal the future of college football.
Don't tell people that, Bill.
No spoilers.
The publisher really loved that title. I'm like, okay. Anyway.
And I also have Parker Fleming, college football consultant at Stats of War. He makes the graphs that make you mad online, and they're supposed you've said before, Parker, they're meant to make you specifically mad online, listener. And you can find his work at cfb-graphs.com. Parker, Bill, thank you for joining me today. How are you both?
Fantastic. It's hoodie weather.
It is hoodie weather.
I live out in the Great West. It's been hoodie weather for a couple months. It's getting on, oh dang, where's my jacket weather here for
was,
me here.
We're approaching like October 20th and it was still in like the mid 80s. I was getting pissed, but then now we're fully immersed all of a sudden.
As a native Floridian who doesn't live there anymore, I'm still adjusting to the concept of hoodie weather. It used to be hoodie weather was, oh, we're going to the movies. That was hoodie
right.
weather. So we are here to talk about strength of schedule. I want to lead this conversation by quoting you, Parker. This is a tweet of yours from November of last year. Almost exactly.
I don't even know what this is going to be. I can't be held responsible for tweets over a year old. I have no idea what this is going to be.
I'm not going to ask you to defend it. But I won't use the screenshot that it's quoting. The tweet is, strength of schedule ratings are just astrology for men. So I want to use that as the bridge for us to have a discussion about strength of schedule, how we talk about it, why we talk about it, the smarter ways we could or should talk about it. And I want to start from this perspective. And Bill, I want to get your understanding first. I think a lot of sports fans look at strength of schedule or hear strength of schedule and they think that's an objective measure in the same way that like bench press is a strength measure or something like that. But it's clearly not, right? There is no sort of like perfect measurement you go to that says like, yes, this is strength of schedule that doesn't have anything baked into it that is inherently subjective.
Right. Yeah. So I think the first time I was knowing that I was going to have this conversation, I was thinking back. I think the first time I started using a strength of schedule number with SP Plus back when I had an ampersand, I think I just used like the average opponent rating basically. And like, here's who's played the highest average opponent. And that worked fine. Except I noticed immediately that people would then say, well, Ohio State's first in SP Plus, but it's with the 84th ranked strength of schedule. They ain't played nobody. So that doesn't count. But when you have an opponent adjusted rating, like strength of schedule is already baked in, and they were like baking it twice. And so I just stopped using it immediately. I'm like, okay, I'm not doing this anymore because it's not at all. Because it really does feel like it's just a measure. Like people just use it as a how big a man are you kind of concept. And that's how it almost sounds like that's how the committee uses it sometimes too. Like they chose not to play a hard schedule. You don't want to reward them for choosing that. Like SMU last year, like they chose not to be in the SEC. But no, I mean, I ended up finding a use for it when I started, I guess it was after the playoff came into existence and I started to realize, you know, you could look at it from the perspective of, and this goes to your point, it's always a different interpretation, but I started using it as like, how would a top five team have performed against your schedule? That ended up being, you know, are you clearing the top five bar or not, basically, with your record? And that made sense to me. So I started using it in that way. People still misinterpreted it and still misused it, but I had a purpose. And it was completely different than the first one I used. So, it really is. It's it ends up being, it's subjective in that you can define it in 100 million different ways. And then, you know, people choose to interpret it correctly or not.
Parker, do you think the label is part of the problem, that people hear strength of schedule and that's not necessarily like what Bill's describing? How would a top five team do against your schedule? It's not necessarily, do you have the toughest schedule in the world? It's sort of like, how did you perform relative to very high expectations, let's say. From your perspective, Parker, like, is this a phrase that even makes sense? Or sort of like, how do you incorporate the concept of strength of schedule into some of your work?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely hard. I think it kind of goes back to my weird theory about why like recruiting rankings are so popular with people, is because it gives fans a number that says, hey, my number is higher than my rivals. We're beating them. And like, I can definitively do that. But as Bill alluded to, it is an unsupervised problem, which means we don't have a training variable where we can say, let's make a good model that absolutely predicts this. It's coming up with a new output to try to rank something we're never actually going to observe, in the fact that strength of schedule is latent with performance and what we see there. I think to settle debates on the margin, it is useful to kind of understand what would an average team do against that schedule. I think there's a couple caveats that you have to hold in the discussion. One, college football is inherently, the postseason process is inherently an arbitrary selection process. They do have some standards, but it's not like the NFL where you win your division or you have the highest record and you go. And so we have these clear paths. And so there's going to be these huge demand for metrics that kind of justify this. The flip side of that is, I do think schedule gets overblown a little bit, just in the standpoint of SEC teams, for instance. Last year we had, 550 of them that wanted to be that last team in the playoff because they all had lost one extra game. And the reality is, well, like, no, you signed up to play in the tougher conference. And
that's what the money's for.
And that's what the money's for. Exactly. And so I think it's hard because it's unsupervised. Fans have a lot of demand for one metric that says, oh, definitively I deserve to be in, or we got screwed. But with looking at it, I think you also have to kind of have an open hand and a closed hand in that. The open hand is kind of saying, all right, in the offseason, there are variable inputs. You can, you know, push off a future schedule and add Incarnate Word into your schedule and change it. In season, you can only play who you're going to play. And sometimes, you know, games that looked good a couple years ago have aged poorly. And so I do think it's nice to, like, on the margin, kind of understand who played who. And the way that I generally try to approach it, I don't put out like a resume metric. I frankly don't care about simulating the playoffs. That's just not something I'm interested in. And I think that the way we could think about this is a little bit more of, how confident are we that this result happened because of a strong signal that this team is of a certain quality, right, as opposed to it's within the bounds of random variance. And so as we're talking about strength of schedule, I do think we're always going to have to reference it on what would an average or a top five, you know, just changing the reference point of average, do. And how confident are we that this team wasn't, oh, they got a couple good bounces and they have some wins above what we think they do. That's where I think it becomes useful at the margin of deciding, all right, where's the cutoff point for deciding among these teams with similar resumes?
The other thing that strikes me as tricky about strength of schedule conceptually for a fan is that it is a like SP plus is Bills. Like, nobody's going to sort of be confused and be like, well, you know, so-and-so's SP plus says this. Like, they know the source it's coming from. They can go bother Bill online and sort of ask him questions. And, you know, I think Bill is pretty upfront about this is how I do this work. This is how I've tweaked it over the years, whatever. But like, to give you a few examples that are true as of this recording, we're recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, October 28th. In 2025, strength of schedule metrics, and I'm going to use ESPN strength of schedule metric, which is not the same as your strength of schedule metric, Bill. Is that correct? Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So for one example, Auburn is 7th in ESPN's metric, 43rd in the NCAA's, and 8th in Sports References. Miami is 36th in ESPN's, 28th in the NCAA's, and 12th in Sports References. I use these not to sort of say like one of them is right or wrong, but I think this sort of reflects that you can get a strength of schedule metric in a lot of different ways. And that feels like a part of the conversation that never happens, where strength of schedule, we go straight to number says this, and that means that. And there's no sort of secondary discussion about like, well, what are we value? What makes a schedule strong or weak? It just becomes sort of like a a way to like opinion launder almost? Does that seem to you both like Bill, does that seem to you like how this ends up getting used in practice a lot of the time?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Auburn's is what in the NCAA?
In the if I have the numbers right, I'll double check it right now. I had them at they were 43rd in the NCAA's current rankings of
like average, you know, alphabetized, like what, how are we? I mean, they played two super weak teams, but my God, how do you, okay. Anyway, I have them eighth. I feel pretty good about them being a top 10 or 15 schedule, but no, I mean, that is even be, you know, your record is your record, but you know, if you're out there searching for material as to, yeah, but we're actually better than that. Or yeah, but our rival is worse than that. Yeah, you have your choice, and suddenly that'll be your favorite measure available. Like suddenly SP Plus is a favorite of every Indiana fan in the country. It's a very accurate number, according to the good folks in Bloomington, Indiana, because they're number one in SP Plus. I'm guessing it's just ammo. It's just all just material I can use, you know, to make myself feel good.
So to unpack why Auburn is so low, like Auburn is in the same category as Michigan State, Kansas, Tulsa, like that's the range that they're in. And that's because, like, and the NCAA will tell you this, the only thing they're using to conduct strength of schedule, which in this case might be closer to strength of resume, is just what are the wins and losses of the teams you've played so far? What's the win-loss record? No measure of how good are those teams? Who have those teams played? Just sort of a straight, what's the winning percentage? So based on that, their highest, the toughest schedule, according to the NCAA's metric, is Colorado, because the teams they've played are 43-12. Like, that's sort of where, but I guess my point is, like, if I'm just, like, an innocent sports fan being like, I'm going to go to the NCAA, they're the official, like, they're the record keepers, here's what they have to say about strength of schedule, I can get an answer that's very different than anything other places would put together. And it feels like that's a hurdle in this conversation, is that they all get the same label. Everything gets labeled steak, and nobody's sort of like, what's actually in this?
Huh. I'll be the token economist in the room and say this is where a good sense of theory comes in before you start throwing numbers together and just grabbing data from sources and saying, what does it mean to have a strong schedule?
Yeah.
And what does it mean? I mean, I love, Bill, you're like Pryor's free resume, SP Plus, I think has Indiana number one a lot right now. I'm kind of like, actually, I don't hate this. It just in terms of, you know, weighting how we move things around. But I think the idea is there's kind of like two dimensions of it, of who did you play and then how did you play against them? And so it's always going to inherently be couched in some kind of a good metric. We'll leave the other, you know, the clearly nonsense ones out. A good metric is always going to be couched in kind of how would a certain reference level of team do against this. And I think that's where they're like, you have to have a lot of uncertainty in this because your ratings are changing every week as well as you observe more about teams and you phase out priors and you get better ideas. And it's, I mean, I think there's weird things, Bill, I had written down to ask you on this, like UCLA, for instance, clearly a tale of two teams, right?
Yep.
Does that win age better in a resume metric just because they've improved a little bit and certain things? Do you think that's going to even out by the end of the season? Or are you saying at the time, this is the information we had, and so that's how we credit it? Again, we can just go down all these rabbit holes of choices that you make to come up with a strength of schedule metric that don't have a clear answer.
Right. I mean, you know, UCLA right now, beating UCLA means you beat the number 78 team in SP Plus. 4 weeks ago, they were 100th. And then last week they were 68th, and then they got crushed again. So they've been, yeah, a lot of these teams are pretty stable, and then a lot are just completely moving targets. Minnesota either goes up or down like 15 spots every week because they cannot decide what they are. But no, I mean, that's it does change a lot. And I bring it on myself because I mean, my resume, like just as I came up with my own way of thinking about strength of schedule, my resume rating was very specific to actually, this is the problem I want to solve. This is the question I want to answer. And it is based on, you know, take the same idea, like average top five team, how would they have done if I projected that team against your schedule, they would come up with a average scoring margin of plus whatever. Your scoring margin is plus whatever. Therefore, it's either better or worse than that average top five team. I really liked that, and it answered a question I wanted, so I rolled with it. And then from the start of the year, you know, because I bring this on myself, I'll do like, if the playoffs started today, resume ratings, or, you know, decided, you know, whatever. Indiana's been number one in resume SP Plus all year, and just a chorus of, but they ain't played nobody, it comes up every single time I post it. So I'm the cause of all my own problems, but I enjoy it. I just like looking at the game that way, instead of just a straight strength of record. Here's what, you know, you've won this many games, the end. I like to know, did you win it by 1 or 50? Because Indiana wins big games by 50, and that's kind of impressive.
The timing thing is interesting to me as well, because I sort of have a hypothesis I want to test with both of you. I want to start with you, Parker. I think there are two smart times, or the two best times to talk about strength of schedule are week zero, when no games have been played, and the end of the regular season, when the whole schedule going into conference championships has been played. And I think everything else in between then has a lot of like, okay, you are measuring something that is actively moving, and you shouldn't get attached to this number now. And you should either be working with no information or as much information as possible. And I want to, like, how does that hypothesis strike you?
Yeah, I think that's good. I mean, from an engagement standpoint, you're probably talking about like July 1 and then like the night of the playoff ranking sure. reveals are probably sure. the best time to, you know, do that. But yeah, I think, you know, understanding the volatility and how it changes, like you're iterating on a problem that is iterating upon itself as you move throughout the season is interesting. I think the way that I think about it more, just in my mindset, is a lot more of, you know, if a team was looking at the rest of the season, what information could the strength of schedule give them? And I think a lot of what I'm thinking about a lot, I'll shout out, Bill, I'm sure you've read How to Win the Premier League by Ian Graham, mm-hmm. The Liverpool. And he talks about specifically in there a specific problem where they, and I'm a Luddite when it comes to soccer, a neophyte. I'm just learning, and I don't know much about it. But he was talking about the specific day game scheduling and how Jurgen Klopp felt like they were playing really, really poorly during the day. And he was like, great, what if I just went and said, what's the probability we would have won these games? Like, what are the range of outcomes? And said, oh, we're within a standard deviation of projected outcomes. Like, no, we're just playing good teams, and this is variance. And so I think throughout the season, that's where you want to hold the open hand of variance and like confidence. What I ran in thinking about this and prepping for this problem was just looking, you know, just coming up with a p-value, very, very stupid, naive statistical way of just saying like, what's the probability that this is statistically significant as opposed to this is just noise? And so that's where you can, in season right now, look at a team like Auburn, who has, you know, is 11th in the simple thing that I just came up with this season, but they have 3.1 expected wins. An average team would be expected to win 3.1s against their schedule. It's probably a little high. We'll talk about that, whatever. But it's a 59.9% confidence that their 0.9 wins above average are statistically significant. So we can say, things you know, I use that because it's an obvious example. We can look back and see like officiating, late game situations, maybe some clock management. All those things are things we could potentially address going forward, knowing, hey, we've had a really hard schedule and we have a lot of uncertainty about whether our results are indicative of success relative to due to normal variance.
Parker, I'm also required to say that the thing that your numbers can account for is referee conspiracies meant to bring down the Auburn Tigers, of course. So.
I mean, it's, you know, referee nonsense over expected would be a great metric. I would love to figure out how to get that into
now, that would do. Schedule. You're talking about engagement. That would do some real numbers.
they ain't ref nobody would be a new level of Twitter discourse, I think. Yeah.
The moving target aspect of everything is kind of interesting, because right now Notre Dame's strength of schedule in my ratings is 6th. Projecting out, looking at their full season strength of schedule, 38th. Because they immediately played the hard teams on the schedule. They just, and USC ended up, you know, perking up a little bit for them. And now it just gets weaker and weaker, and at least until they lose to Pitt, which I'm all in on. Pitt just does everything the most antisocial way. They install a freshman quarterback and suddenly become great. But that's exactly like their strength of record is good right now, better than I expected in the numbers for a 2-loss team. They're really gonna be pretty high in the playoff rankings next week, and it's interesting to think about that, because, you know, obviously the playoff committee, I've been in the room, that I see the process, they go team by team, like it's a good process for what it is, but like if they get credit right out of the gate here for a pretty hard schedule, do they ever get less credit for that moving forward with every weak opponent, or did they still have that schedule that they had when people started talking about them in early November? I don't know the answer. I guess the answer is we know that if they go 10-2, they're in. But it is kind of interesting that it's a very, very weak home stretch for them, obviously.
That goes into kind of the recursive issue that I brought up with UCLA earlier, Bill, is like, the anchoring bias of what was their strength of schedule early on. Right. And then how does that, you know, how do we reiterate on that as it moves, knowing that the first number you saw is going to kind of inform how you see the rest of it, and to demonstrate how hairy the problem could theoretically get. Bill, if I hear what you're saying, you look totally backwards and say a top yes. five team would have this scoring margin, you have this scoring margin.
Right.
What you don't do, but you could do that would get exponentially larger, right. would say, let me simulate out the rest of the season based on my numbers, simulate out what a top five team would have.
Yeah.
And then update that every week, and that you can see how that could explode and be super complex, even if it's a little more informative, but then also opens up this entire garden of forking paths of choices for what do you choose to do with that, that then informs what the metric is right now.
Yeah, I've been a friend of mine and I have been fiddling with a playoff odds, basically, because it's such a hard thing to do. My buddy Justin has come up with just basically it's a series of heuristics, like a one loss ACC team is here and a two loss SEC team is here. And you kind of have to do that to a certain degree. But I have been fiddling with the idea of making what amounts to like a projected resume SP plus, like if you win all the games by exactly the amount you're projected to moving forward, here's where you'll end up ranking. And could we use that in any way? But I mean, I don't know. I don't know if there's – it's going to be really interesting to see if the committee having all this quote-unquote extra strength of schedule information this year makes a damn bit of difference, because they already kind of had in their head what a team's strength of schedule was, whether that was an accurate impression or not. And I think in the end it's going to come down to, you know, did you go 10-2 or 9-3 in a lot of cases, and what conference are you in? So
the – sort of like the idea of we people, fans, playoff committee, coaches, whoever, get locked into strength of schedule. To some extent, I imagine that also starts with the preseason, where we have sort of like, okay, here's everybody rankings of who has the – listen, as a Florida fan who had to hear about Billy Napier's strength of schedule for seemingly his entire tenure, this was sort of like the first entrance point you had in some ways to sort of say this is what the road looks like ahead. But – Bill, I'm looking at like your preseason SB Plus strength of schedule compared to the current SB Plus resume, and like Vandy was fifth in the preseason projections. They're down to 47th.
Yeah.
Illinois was 40th, and they're up to 8th. And so I don't say that to sort of say like you were wrong and stupid, but like that feels like one of the most challenging things about talking about strength of schedule before games have been played is like, hey. Like, sort of, how do you build something where you're like, I think this will be, I want this to be meaningful as a look ahead, but I understand that, like, it has even more variance than we've played half the schedule, but, you know, the relative strengths of the teams we've already played and the teams we're yet to play still have some wiggle room to them.
Right. We have an idea in our head before the season starts of who was brave, who was bold in their scheduling and who wasn't. Meanwhile, you have Illinois suddenly playing the number one and two team in the country since Indiana was projected in the 20s and is now first. And USC's up into the teens. And then at the same time, you have Ohio State, who was projected to play an elite team in the first week of the season. Turns out they did not do that. They haven't played a top 10 team yet. Their strength of schedule today, it's barely a top 50. And so, it's always going to kind of be that way, because whether you're using SP Plus, whether you're using preseason polls, we're going to get most of the teams right. But the ones we whiff on, it appears in this age, we're going to whiff even harder on them. And also that is going to alter, like Clemson, LSU and Clemson to start the season turned out to not be all that big a game. But it kind of altered the way we looked at LSU down the line. So that's always the way it's going to be. And you know, I think the answer is we should be flexible and in our thinking and be willing to think new things. But that's not quite how this tends to go.
Yeah, and I think this goes into, and I might, Ryan, I'm going to hijack and segue here. I hope that's okay. That goes into one, Bill, I'm sure you're noticing and as well, a lot of comments about, you know, everybody stinks this year and people saying that. I think what's happening is, especially the last 2 years, we're seeing that like helmet scouting in the post-Saban college football era doesn't work anymore. You can't just look at a team and be like, oh, I know what they are. I know what they're going to be. It requires more work. And that kind of gets into, I'm curious your thoughts, Bill, about power ratings versus, you know, the Vegas, like Lane Kiffin the other day said, recycled the Saban quote about, well, you know, Vegas does a better job. How do you approach that idea of like, you create power ratings that are forward looking, and then you also create a resume ranking.
Right.
Where does that factor into how we should decide the postseason of the sport?
Yeah. I mean, if your proposal for how things go would benefit teams for just forfeiting games the rest of the season, you might not be thinking about things clearly like, oh, Vegas thinks of us as this. Well, we're not playing another game. We're good. We're in. I fiddled a lot with that. You know, in previous years, I found, you know, one of the times a few years ago when I got annoyed with the committee, I came up with a little formula of like, I'm going to come up with a little like a BCS type formula, and not the BCS itself with like, whatever the hell Sagarin and whatever the super weird ones were back in the day. But, you know, I was like, all right, I'm going to use SP Plus and FPI. I'm going to use resume SP Plus and strength of record. I'm going to incorporate the polls. So it's kind of BCS-ish. And here's what they should do. And then I cranked it out and I realized that was exactly the playoff top 25. That was pretty much, I'd stumbled on like, here's exactly what the playoff committee is going to think, except for like one exception each time, like say Alabama over Florida State 2 years ago. So I've been thinking a lot since then about like, what should they do, or what should all this talk in the offseason about a formula and replacing this all over again, which I'm all for, like, what should we do in that regard? And I mean, short answer is, I don't know. Cause if you use computers too much, for among other things, Alabama gets in over SMU last year and you're punishing teams for making the conference title game. But it is a really interesting thought. Like I guess this is probably eye of the beholder stuff right here. But I have been fiddling just the last couple of weeks with let me just blend resume SP Plus and strength the record together and see what it says. And I think it tells a pretty interesting story. And you know, we'll see exactly what I'm pretty sure the committee is not going to be any different this year with their new metrics than they were last year. But we'll see what that spits out.
It also strikes me that this is one of the hardest sports in which to apply a strength of schedule rating across the board. Like in the NFL, this is so much easier, like so much so that the NFL can kind of tilt the strength of schedule axis in part by saying, okay, you're going to play three games based on who was in your same spot in the division, in a certain division from the previous year. So Bill, to spell this out for the audience, we're going to take Bills Dolphins. This year, the Bills the Dolphins got to play the second place teams from the AFC West, NFC East, and AFC South because Miami finished second in their division last year. So they drew the Chargers, Colts, and Commanders. I'm curious if like there is some sense to reimagining college football scheduling to accommodate for this in some way, shape, or form. Like it occurs to me that part of the problem, and Parker, you sort of alluded to it, is your schedule gets drawn up so far in advance. Like the SEC already has the 2029 conference slate set.
Yeah.
And if you had said, if you had 4 years ago said you're playing Vanderbilt, you would have marked that and been like, great. I'm so happy that we get Vanderbilt on the road. That's easy. And now if you get Vanderbilt, that means something very different. So this is, I'm not asking either of you to sort of like completely reimagine the sport, but should there be more opportunity to rebalance schedules like this on a year to year basis to try to directly address inequities in strength of schedule, in your opinions? Parker, you want to go first?
Yeah. So one, you're talking about centralized scheduling, mm-hmm. which might never happen in the NCAA just because of how things happen, but also financially, like it might be good for Kent State's win total to get paired up against some of the lower teams. That program will not survive unless they make a couple million dollars going and getting the tar kicked out of them at certain places. Yep. Like the financial reality is something that would have to be addressed in that as well. I'll also, speaking of old tweets, I'll go back to one from 2021 for me. College football needs a scheduling year of Jubilee. Like, we need to say this is a new era. We've got to wipe everything off the books, and then we're not going to schedule anything out 2 weeks in advance. I was so optimistic, maybe naive, maybe young, sweet Parker thought something cool would happen during COVID.
BYU Coastal
moved mountains to play a football game. You're like, wait, you didn't need to know about this 10 years in advance. You drove the truck through snow across the country. Like, it can happen. And I think that's where, like, it has to come centrally, because one, there's a fundamental lack of mistrust to go to a game theory standpoint. Why would I inconvenience myself and make a super hard schedule when it's just, and this is probably what the SEC teams are thinking, is going to be thrown in my face by a bad team who gets lucky because they scheduled nobody and they get all this media favoritism for being an underdog, yada, yada. That like inherent distrust in this game means that it's not going to work itself out in the market, coupled with the financial reality. Like centralized scheduling becomes really, really complicated because you need to help teams float. Teams are going to complain about their schedule no matter what happens. And the huge talent and quality differences across the college football landscape mean that like a balanced schedule is weird. Toss in on that, and I'll shut up after this and let Bill hop in. But like 18-team conferences in college football are like an affront to taste and decency. Like I believe they stink in God's nostrils, just from a fundamental, like the imbalanced schedule, the fact that the Big 12 is going to have like six teams at the top, and then we're going to have to do a tiebreaker for the final two, like completely unsatisfying, completely, I think, and it flies in the face of what the sport is. And so centralized scheduling would also have to come with realignment. And again, we've seen how that's gone.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is obviously an area where I've had 4 million ideas. There's the bracket buster idea, where based on your success to a certain point in the season, you get paired off with other teams in your tax bracket, so to speak, and everybody gets a nice early November test. There's the idea of, if we're going to have conferences this damn big, let's split them in two. Let's have promotion and relegation from within, and that way, you know, you can't say all of this year's contenders will play each other, but all of last year's contenders will play each other this year. And that's usually going to cover things except in the Big 12, I guess. And, you know, there are all these sorts of things we can do. And you're right. I think back to two things from COVID. The only two good things that came out of COVID were, number one, proof that you can schedule a game in 3 days and play it. And we should take advantage of that. And number two was the Big Ten's idea that they originally came up with, it got blown up because too many teams are having to cancel because of positive tests. But the idea that we're going to get to championship week and then everybody's going to play another game based loosely on the standings, it's kind of what they turned their gross 4 auto bid play-in thing into. But it had a great start at the start, where you could, you're not going to punish like Indiana and Ohio State right before they go play in the playoff this year. They're going to play each other in a game that maybe makes like a difference of two in the seeds. Like the winner is going to get the one seed and the loser is going to get the three or something. And then they're going to play the playoff having just played this extra game and maybe it's gotten somebody hurt and everything. You know, you could actually incorporate the conference title game within a 12-game schedule and, you know, keep some of the miles off. And we saw how they planned to do it, and that was a pretty cool idea. And instead we'd mutated it into something gross. And but those ideas are out there, and what we found since COVID is, yeah, these are new things are pretty cool, but let's not change a damn thing. Let's just keep doing it like we're doing it, because it's gotten us to this point.
Can I put on my tinfoil hat for a second?
Sure, please do.
That's okay.
That's usually my job. I'm happy to pass it off.
One thing we're also looking at here is, we've seen that, you know, the Big Ten and now the SEC is talking about conference games and scheduling a requirement for power teams. I wonder if the scheduling discussion is going to kind of become mute, because both of those conferences can strategically cross schedule with the certain subset of teams and effectively box out into a de facto Premier League.
Yeah.
So I wonder if the next couple of years we're not going to see conversations about like, oh, they didn't play anybody in the Big Two. Right. And not to be that, you know, Sankey is super insidious. I think I could believe that. I'm not saying he is, but the idea of saying like, okay, legally we're going to get screwed if we try to do the Premier League. Why don't we just wither everything else in the sport away into its own league by only scheduling within this certain realm? I think that's what we're going to start to see happen. And that's where balanced scheduling becomes a little bit, you know, the pathways to the postseason get redefined, the balanced scheduling becomes a little bit more clear. And if they don't try to create a de facto Premier League by how they're scheduling and boxing teams out.
No, that's, I mean, that's, as it turned out, Ralph Russo had all the best quotes in my book, which, you know, I shouldn't be surprised by. He's Ralph Russo. But I mean, he basically, when we were talking about this, he was saying, like, we're in the Super League. Like, they also, they already get almost everything they want. The two conferences do. The two conferences with all the teams that would end up in some sort of Super League structure, all they have to do is just, you know, deign to allow a Big 12 team in their playoff. They already arranged to get all the money from the playoff. We could have funded everyone's house settlement budget to a certain degree with the new money derived from a 12-team playoff, and instead the Big Ten and SEC then said nope, and took it all. And like, that's like, they already get so much of what they want, they don't need to change anything. The only way a quote-unquote Super League comes into existence is if good old private equity basically doesn't go to the SEC and Big Ten, but goes to Ohio State and like Alabama and says, you could make double if you just play each other. And they'd have to, maybe that works, but I don't feel as confident in that scenario as some sort of like Big Ten and SEC merger. They don't have to do that because they already get what they want.
Part of why I sort of harp on the idea of should we be taking more effort to sort of address, to manufacture strength of schedule in real time or something close to real time, is in like teams like Indiana last year, they get dragged for like, oh, they're, you know, like it gets thrown out as a stain on them, like a moral choice that they yep. made. And you look at it and like, I think that makes some sense in men's and women's college basketball, where you're making something like 35 to 40% of your schedule. You're deciding like which of these, you know, tournaments in the Virgin Islands am I going to go play in? Who am I going to play out of conference? Like, you get to shape a lot of it. In college football, like, going forward, it's going to be like maybe a quarter of your schedule. And that doesn't account for like if you are Kentucky, like, well, you know, we kind of want to keep playing Louisville. We're not picking whether we're doing that to make our schedule hard or easy or anything like that.
Yep.
So it feels like there is no way to sort of use strength of schedule as a pro or a con to influence those kind of decision makings for teams, because like, they can't really like, could Indiana have changed one game last year on their schedule and like completely erased all the concerns about right. strength of schedule that they had? I don't think they could have.
And also, they weren't heading into last year saying, we need to make our schedule as easy as possible right. for our inevitable college football playoff run. They were scheduling to try to get to 6 wins more right. than anything.
Right.
And I do think that's part of it, is like, I do envision, like, if, you know, you put me in charge of all schedules, I will ask each team, okay, are you wanting cake, or are you wanting something harder with more money? Are you an ambitious mid-major, like wanting some big game, and try to, you know, fold that into the preferences to some degree? Are you Louisiana Monroe and you just need to play your 3 bye games so you can afford your athletic department? You know, that's, you know, you take that into account to some degree. But yeah, it is, like I said, it's a big, how big a man are you? And Indiana, as we remember last year's discussions, wasn't a man.
And again, I've got a couple tinfoil hats over here. That's where a rev share minimum would sort.
Yeah.
And that way you would do that without the courts, and you would do that in a way that you wouldn't be casting anyone off per se. You just say like, hey, the teams that want to play ball, that are expecting to compete for a national championship, we're going to spend at least X. Everybody else, great. Like, we love these bowls, and you know that, like, your programs can exist. Your students can have opportunities. I think that's long-term going to be bad for those lower programs, but I also think that's on the horizon as well, as a self-sorting mechanism where ideally you could, I mean, I talked to people in Nashville in August about, you know, what do you expect this year? And guys are saying, if we went to a bowl and annoyed somebody this year, that would be amazing. And to kind of have those expectations in mind would be good. I think we're going to get the revelation of the preferences and year over year expectations by that salary or that revenue sharing floor that's potentially on the horizon.
I want to direct this to the place that strength of schedule always turns up these days, and that is the playoff rankings and the playoff seeding and decision making. Bill, let's start with you. How should a playoff committee use strength of schedule? What sort of formula should they use? Like, in your mind, what is the best way to incorporate this into a holistic decision, a subjective decision in the end, but let's say an informed subjective decision about who should make the playoff?
Well, by using resume SP Plus, of course.
No, I mean, TM, like and subscribe.
That's right. I mean, that's... I mean, that's a joke answer, but it is also like just do whatever you need to do to take into account how hard your schedule was and how well you played against it. That's all, because late in the year, it's so funny. You know, in the last 15 years, I've been told many times, watch the games, nerd. But at the end of every regular season, I'm saying, watch the games. You're not just because it sounds like they're just, well, they played their best win is this, and they played this team, and we're just moving teams around based on how big a man were you and how many quality losses, and et cetera. Like, watch the games and understand who's good. And you don't need a specific number to figure out, okay, they're playing a bad team right now, but they're looking really, really good, and they're treating a bad team like an elite team would. Like beating a bad team 63-0 versus, the 28-0, there's a difference. And it's not just all intent or, whether you're a bad person, you want to run up the score. So no, I don't think it'll hurt for them this year to have some sort of extra metric in front of them. I wish I knew more about that metric. Because saying strength of schedule means a lot of different things. So I'd like to know what we're getting into there. And if we want to go to strict formula, what was it, college hockey, that just basically comes up with a formula that nobody really likes, but also basically lays out, here's what you're going to have to do to make the playoff. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't hate that either.
It's transparent, at least.
Right. Like, bad formula, I guess in my head, bad formula that you know the stakes of is at least better than,
mystery
whatever.
Mystery formula that can be... That can be ham-fistedly explained after any playoff ranking. Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, I just want a smart committee to have smart discussions, and that, because what happens in that room, to a certain degree, is they all have all this data in front of them, and you count the green dots, because you can basically compare team A to team B and all these stats, some of them good, some of them bad. Like, I think points per yard or something was one of them on there, and that is volatile and tells you how lucky you were more than how good you were and all these other things. But you just look at, compare two teams, and the one with the better numbers in a given category has a green dot by their name, and the other one has a red dot, and you end up just immediately looking at the page and going, oh, green, good, green, they're good. Better, rank higher. And that's still better than not using data, probably, but it's still like it's kind of the bare minimum of what they could be doing.
Parker, if you're in the playoff committee room, what are you telling them to do when it comes to strength of schedule?
I try to bring it down from the inside. No, I'll save all my ramblings about how college football doesn't need a national champion or even a playoff, and now, kind of defeats the purpose of sport, yada, yada. We'll put all that in a box for now. But I think that's kind of the big deal with like the BCS and the transition, is I think there were legitimate criticisms about the system. Specifically, they kept messing with it every year, so we didn't really understand like the ramifications year over year, because everyone is up in arms every year and kind of messing with it. And two, we like overcorrected and said like, oh, well, if the number's bad, then let's just do whatever we want. And we've seen that's not like great.
Computer is evil. Overall. We hate computer.
Yeah. It's back to our new stone age for a little bit in college football. I think transparency is key. I think that it should be like publicly trackable, and we should know what's going in there. I think most of the people involved in the college football playoff committee should not be anywhere near like Twitter at all, and shouldn't respond to any kind of fan sentiment. It should try to be as objective as possible. I think multiple blind resumes should be selected among, and you should do an ensemble approach, in the fact that we don't want to, over-index on the helmet scouting and moving through. But I think the biggest thing there is I'm worried about, and this could be a whole nother discussion, but like the selection process in itself, there's probably a lot of bias based on like where you start. Think, for an example, everybody who loves college football has drawn a realignment map. And you can basically tell where that person went to school based on kind of where they start their realignment map. I think that probably happens with the playoff as well, is like, if you start with Indiana as your number one and you say, all right, we're going to build off of this, you're probably biased in your 12 and 13 rankings because of where you started, versus if you started with Alabama or BYU or whoever as your number one. So there's probably ways to like do that multiple times with blind resumes to try to get an aggregate approach. But I do think transparency is really, really key. And I think, laying that out, looking at, they've done some good ones about like, let's re-rank the past and kind of see what that is. I think that would be super useful as an exercise to understand what's at stake, because the big deal is you want teams to know what's in their control before the season starts so that they can try to maximize their probability. Off season, mess with it, like that's fine. But in season, there needs to be clear guidelines, and college football is never going to have, you won your division, so you're in. I think that formula really needs to be transparent so teams can understand what they need to do.
Yeah, that was always my thing with the BCS. I've said this line a million times, but the one number that the BCS screwed up was it could only pick two teams. And therefore, inevitably, the third team had, we decided, got screwed. And then we figured out how to change the formula so that the third team would have gotten in instead. And that's the complete wrong approach in every possible way. But we continued to do it and it never got smarter. So
I want to end with a question that will completely undermine the entire premise we've been talking about today, but it is informed by both of your work. It seems like there is a narrowing going on in college football where, I don't know if parity is the right word, but something closer to parity is showing up, where we are seeing like there isn't the true, the same separation of like, here's the top like five teams and here's everybody else. Like everybody is coming closer to the middle in some ways. If that's true, and you can correct me if you think that's not, does that sort of mean that strength of schedule stops meaning that much anymore? Like, are we getting to a point where, oh, I have the 25th ranked strength of schedule, and you only have the 50th, and it's like, yeah, you know what? The difference between those in a more equal college football structure where, like, the level of play is more equal across the sport doesn't really matter, and it's a silly thing to fight over.
Yeah, I mean, I think basically, well, a couple of weeks ago, I looked at, just compared the distribution of SP Plus to where it was. I think it was in 2019 and 2014, because those are the first 2 years I was able to find that were kind of equally spaced. And the top eight teams this year were all worse, and then like 9 through 25 were all a little better. And I think that very much matched kind of the impression I had. There are a lot of different definitions of parity. One of them is like, can the G5 keep up? And that is obviously, there's no parity. That's only getting worse. But the idea of light heavyweights keeping up with heavyweights does seem to be, there seems to be a little merit to it. There's one caveat to that I'm very curious about this year. It really, really feels, and they've had the schedule to do it, it really feels like Ohio State's been in third gear all year.
Sure. Yeah.
Because especially when it turned, they didn't beat Texas by a lot, but since then they've just been cruising along and like, oh, that's cute, Ohio. We'll let you punch us a couple times. You're never going to score. So, and eventually we'll pull away. It feels very Patriots. Back when in the mid 2010s, when I was trying to come up with an NFL model, I immediately fell into the Patriots trap of, I don't think they're very good. They've been, and it turned out they were legitimately just playing here because they had the schedule to do it, and then they hit the gas in the playoff and exceeded projections massively every week. Feel like that's what Ohio State's doing, so, and that's part of, you know, they're only second right now in SP Plus. They're only like at a whatever they are, 28 or so, as opposed to like a 35 or whatever the best Alabama teams were at. And I think that's like at least slightly by choice. They're going to try to turn it on for Michigan. They're going to turn it on for Indiana and go from there. But they learned every lesson they needed to last year about just like, get the record you need to get in the door, and we'll worry about peaking in December. I don't think it's that easy. Like, okay, now hit the gas or anything like that. But it feels like that's what they're trying to do. And that kind of skews. If SP Plus doesn't know you're not in fifth gear or trying real hard, it can't. It'll make you look more mediocre than you are. So I'm curious how that plays out.
Yeah. What is it like 2022 Georgia, where I almost wanted to put like a did they care this weekend variable in the results to smooth it out, because you just knew they could massacre anybody. I think, Bill, great answer. And I echo everything you say in there. I think the one thing I'll add when we're talking about that is the most valuable thing, the kind of optimization problem as talent is dispersing throughout the sport, is you want to maximize quality on the field subject to health. I think as the season gets longer, keeping your players healthy has become more important. And that's where you get like the wins are hard. Yeah, wins are hard because talent is flattening a little bit. But also, if I have to play my starters 60 minutes a game for 12 weeks, we're going to get our ass beat in the playoff. That is going to happen. We saw many teams run out of gas at the end of last season. And so I think that's the calculation as well. It's less a, hey, it's hard to keep 18-year-olds focused for multiple weeks. That's true. But also, I think coaches are very aware that it's hard to keep 18-year-olds healthy if they're playing 60 minutes a week for the entire season. And so how can we maintain that health while preserving the quality on the field? That's something latent that's going to be hard to measure, but I think it's worth keeping an eye on as we talk about strength of resume, especially in a sport that loves to deal with hypotheticals of, oh, well, they were trying, or they could have beat this team by 30, whatever. There is a legitimate reason why teams might be kind of quote unquote sleepwalking in some situations to get through.
Yeah, and I should very much like Ryan Day is doing exactly what I would do in his situation. I just hate it as a fan and as somebody who wants to actually watch Ohio State try, because it's usually pretty impressive watching them try. It's not necessarily great from an entertainment standpoint.
Thank you to Bill and Parker for joining me on this episode. Bill's new book is Forward Progress: The Definitive Guide to the Future of College Football, and we recommend it for anyone who wants to better understand how this sport actually works, which, well, if you listen to this whole show, you probably do. Parker can be found at Stats O' War on Blue Sky and Twitter, and he puts a lot of his work on cfb-graphs.com as well. And as always, thanks to you, our paid subscribers, for making this show and all the others like it possible. Phantom Island is produced by Michael Serber and presented by Homefield. Our theme music by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard comes from the song Phantom Island from their album of the same name. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.